Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Okay, welcome back, and it is now or never. And I'm going to lead for a while on this, that you have to understand that our debt is fraud. As a matter of fact, the reason why we're kind of doing this exorcism, because the progressives at the, you know, as it goes back to Hamilton, wanting to actually assume debt to give the federal government energy to tax. Remember, the federal government only needed to operate based on what its debt was, what it needed to do. So it was acquiring debt, but it wasn't enough to levy serious taxation upon the states. And they knew that the states couldn't necessarily pay it, which is why they also went out and sought a loan. But this goes out, and the way they did the first financing were treasury bonds and those types of things. So, in other words, out the gate, Hamilton was very busy in playing financial mayhem upon the United States. Now, putting aside, you know, what actually happened really doesn't matter. The Constitution did not give Hamilton the power to create a bank. The reason he justified the need for a bank was because of the first unconstitutional act that he got Thomas Jefferson to advocate. And this is why these guys finally realized how evil of a guy he was. And from that point, they started kind of containing him. But when you really look at the things that Hamilton was doing in the very beginning, from assuming the debt and working on the legal side of slavery regarding identifying those who were had predilections in supporting slavery and maintaining it. Why is that important? Because he had a list of judges that he was able to hand Adams when Adams was being unseated by Jefferson, so that Adams would actually place these lawyers as judges into the federal circuit to help propagate, because go look at Taney. Taney was from Maryland. Go look at the details of this man. He was one of those that was kind of identified, or actually he was created via and his ascension to power as the Supreme Court Chief Justice. This was all about how to develop and how to look for these types of people that would be divisive. And so whether Hamilton's hand was on it, he basically created the formula and or the formula or recipe, whichever you want to call it, to ensure that there was always a level of division, because it was very clear that slavery out the gate was one of the things to keep the states divided. If you want to centralize power, you have to divide and conquer. And that's exactly what he started putting into play with Marshall and many of, I'll just say, the protégés, or those people who were influenced by Hamilton's just deviousness. I guess that's the best way to say it. But anyway, regardless of all of these things, when you really look at what the Constitution allowed, the only mechanism to actually get back to clean the purity, to dismantle the bank and the financial system that was created unconstitutionally, then we absolutely have to go down to the states at the state level, the parents of the federal government. Now, actually, I shouldn't go down. We should need to go up the chain to the states, because the smallest government, even though it may have a large amount of power, it needed that power to fight wars, not to subjugate the states and to subjugate the people. That was clearly the design. And not giving them the ability to own land, not giving them the ability to become rich in resources and to And to play that type of affluence worldwide, that was not the intent. And so, and that was clear through, that's one of the reasons why we cover all of the documents. And this year we included the notes, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. So anyway, as we kind of look, and the reason why this is important, because I have been doing this exorcism, this political exorcism, to kind of set the record straight. The Constitution, the way it is, and I'm on the record for this, the way it is with the existing amendments even, none of those amendments really are holding us back. I mean, there are some that may be problematic, but the 17th Amendment does not take the state's authority, the state legislature's authority of suffrage over those senators. Those senators are obligated to give the state their suffrage. The 5th Article of the Constitution demands it, that if the states have not given up that, and the 17th Amendment didn't give senators that authority to ignore the states. Just to be clear, I want you to understand that even though these may be, and they've the Constitution from every end has been perverted, and the 17th Amendment, the 16th Amendment, the 14th, all of these good amendments, or I shouldn't say good, the 14th Amendment is definitely a good amendment. The 16th and 17th Amendment was not necessary. It wasn't necessary. It was a problem that was created to absolutely undo or to be redefined down the road so that they could undo America. But the amendments themselves did not undo America. The 16th Amendment did not undo it. The 16th Amendment only changed the direct tax of a duty to the states from that to income. And we'll get into that. But more before I dive into all of that, I know last Friday, just a couple days ago, I spoke about the oath. Now, I tell you that there's really only one Constitution. And most people going into office do not realize that when they're taking an oath, they may be actually taking an oath that says that they're supporting the annotated Constitution. I don't know if that language is very clear to the individuals that are doing this. And I believe that the bonds and those types of things, because there's nowhere in the Constitution that required, or where did this requirement for a bond come in? It wasn't in the oath, the very first act of the oath and administering an oath, and that people needed to have bonds. So however that started coming in became, you know, an undermining. And it's one of those things, if you want to, you know, hunt and do the due diligence, you really need to do the due diligence. Like on the 16th Amendment, I have an article. I actually have a thesis of why you don't have to pay income tax. And I have not gone through, it's on my website. And it goes through the 16th Amendment, and it provides the interpretation of what's being said in that. The problem is that the individual that did that, I'm providing that, whether it's true or not, I'm just providing that so that you can start doing a dive into the 16th Amendment. Just like the 14th Amendment, and the reason why we're going to get back into the 14th Amendment is because Kurt Lash points out that you have to look at the comments being made and where that person was standing. If that person was standing on an opposition side or whatever their ulterior motives were they promoting it or were they trying to oppose it, trying to undermine it or what have you. So we have to do the due diligence to figure out where these people were. And the only way to really do that is you have to look at how they voted. Now, we know that the 16th Amendment was voted by a majority. So we just have to look at, and this is why I tell you, the best thing to do when you're dealing with a record is to color code it. Color code those who voted for it so you can look at their comments and what they said. Why that's important is because they're the ones that created the accepted, air quotes here, accepted terms and stipulations regarding that clause going into the compact. Now, with the 16th Amendment, the way it was done, these men did not, even if you go to Wikipedia, and you look at their details on the 16th Amendment, and again, I really need to scrub the article that I put up, or that, well, actually, I think it has a byline on it. Let me go to it, so, because I've actually got it in front of me. It's the Family Guardian website, and they call it the Great Hoax, why we don't owe income tax. Now, if you read the 16th Amendment, it says it gives the federal government the ability to, you know, to collect direct income tax, regardless of the source. This is why we have to go through this with a fine-tooth comb. But regardless of the language of the 16th Amendment, it does not give the government the authority to have a progressive or a varying scale taxation on different people. The concept of uniformity was very clear in the Constitution, and the 16th Amendment does not include anything regarding that uniformity. So in other words, if they want to collect an income tax, then they have to have a uniform mechanism of doing that. The language of the 16th Amendment is very problematic because the taxation of income tax does not distinguish between corporations, private entities, or anything like that. And you can see the language was talking about corporations and so forth within this article. But to be clear, the language of the constitutional amendment does not facilitate a differentiation so that they can create scales where corporations pay a standard 28% tax and the people have based on their income, a progressive scale. The more money you make, the more penalties you pay. Now, when I dive into that, and I'll dive into this a little bit more later, as I've already scoured through the documents, they really don't deal with uniformity, and the language does not deal with uniformity. And that right there is the rub. Because Article 1, Section 8, the preamble clearly states that it must be uniform throughout the states or throughout the republic. It does, putting aside apportionment, enumerations, and everything else. Uniformity, it does not give them the ability to break that uniformity. Anyway, so the 16th Amendment, I want to kind of close that. But going back to the oath, because I don't know if I just closed that because I kind of wandered down a rat hole on the 16th. When we look at the individuals that are serving, this is why it is very important that you get them to sign a pledge. Now, we have a pledge. Go through it. If there's a way we can make these pledges better, I want your input. Pull it in, you know, convert it into a Word document, or just tell me what we need to do to change this to make it stronger. But you need to understand that the people that you vote for understands that the original Constitution is not the annotated Constitution. In other words, you have to really help them differentiate and clarify that the oath of office, the law of the land, the supreme law of the land requires that they take an oath to this Constitution. And what's really interesting is the fact that that language in the Constitution actually exists. I mean, when you read Article 6 of the Constitution, I'm sorry, but, you know, this oath of office is, you know, you can't avoid this. That the senators and representatives, this is what it says in Article 6, that the senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislatures and all executive and judicial officers of both the states of the United States and of the several states shall be bound by an oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. So do you think The divine hand of providence knew that there was going to be other constitutions, that the language actually specified this constitution? I think he did. There's no doubt in my mind he knew what we would be dealing with. And so this is why you have to help your public servants and demand that they understand that this is the Constitution, not this redefined Constitution. So I was promising myself I wasn't going to get too passionate, so my fluctuation and amplitude would not change too much, because it simplifies my editing, because I try to make sure that the audio output is as best as possible. That's the only editing I do. I'd never change or edit out content. Now, anyway, with all that being said, these pledges are integral to the oath. And I want you to actually go down to Reclaiming the Republic and go to, let me find it here. I believe it's the endorsement page. And when you're looking at the endorsement page, it's right at the very, very top. Okay, so it's the Your State Pledge. It's called Candidate Endorsements specifically. If you go to the Candidate Endorsements page, Your State Pledge is right at the top. Now, I don't, and as a matter of fact, I clarify who are those candidates that I am endorsing directly without any qualifications. But I act without, not actually, there are qualifications, but because they've met the standards. And this is why I kind of clarify why endorsements are important and not lightly given. This goes back to the principle that I used to argue with people that if you weren't going to vote, how important it was to vote for the lesser of two evils. And how I've realized that voting for the lesser of two evils, especially for your representation, it's an untenable situation. You're better off allowing the Democrats to win. If you're living in a Republican stronghold, you're better off to let a Republican win or Democrat to win and force the issue with those in the party. You know, why is it that we can't come up with a non-Democrat candidate? Because if you vote for a Republican that's a Democrat, then that person is stuck in office and you'll never get rid of them. We had that problem with CMR. I complained with about Kathy McMorris Rodgers. Now, she's stepping down. She's not running for re-election this year, so she's not going to be in office. So in our congressional district, we have an opportunity to actually find and support a candidate that is actually going to live up to that oath of office. That's why this is so important. And as a matter of fact, we're really close, and I want to talk a little bit about this, but I don't want to really play all the cards out. But in Washington State, because I have the direct ear of people within, the political scene, we might actually have an opportunity to get a slate. Now, I want to explain this to you. If you can get a slate of Republicans who signed this pledge to fulfill their oath of office, then they are literally signing up to do the necessary deed. Now, I'm saying this because I received today, it was forwarded, this article regarding how the Missouri GOP has literally flipped. The conservatives in the Missouri GOP has been so fed up, because Missouri is such a red state. There's lots of red states that are like this. Wyoming is just like this. And apparently, and as a matter of fact, here's the interesting thing with Wyoming. Wyoming is really ultra-conservative. The GOP is ultra-conservative. And actually, it's the most constitutional GOP out of all of the states, out of all of them. Missouri is flipping, but is it going to go down the path of supporting Republic review and supporting full compliance of the Constitution? Where in Wyoming, we actually have county central committees that are demanding constitutional compliance committees be formed in the county because they can't get, there's a big separation in the GOP in Wyoming from those people who are playing with their laws. In other words, their legislators and their representatives. In other words, this goes back to what I just said. You're better off allowing a Democrat to take that office for 2 years and work on, you know, doing a destruction campaign on them. Because if it's a Republican, it doesn't matter. People will just ignore the complaints. They'll just ignore it. And the money will actually rule at the end of the day, and the rhinos will keep on getting elected. And so Missouri's going to be walking into that same buzzsaw until people start signing a pledge so that they know and their constituents know that they have obligated themselves to this Constitution and to support it without any reservations. Therefore, when we kind of go down, you know, the concept of how important this oath is, you know, if you're not using tools to help them, or let me back up. There's not one person out there that wants to be held accountable. There's not one person out there that says, hey, you know, nail me to the wall. Nobody wants to be nailed to the wall. So this is why your public servants, regardless of how good they are, they'll refuse to sign anything that will nail them to the wall. So let me ask you this. If you agree with that fundamental tenet that you really have to be an angel, you'd have to be a saint to say, you know, nail me to the wall. anybody that has any reservations regarding the 14th Amendment, anybody that has any derogatory comments about those radical Republicans that drew that 14th Amendment and passed it, and they say those guys were evil, just remember, they were the only class so far in America, other than the framers, they were the only class of those at the trough of power that said, nail me to the wall, because Section 3 of the 14th Amendment galvanized in the law the ability to nail our public servants to the wall, holding them accountable to their oath of office in supporting this Constitution. And as a matter of fact, I know I've seen some people doing research, because this is, you know, it's a beautiful thing that more and more people are getting educated on the Constitution, because we're getting people that are diving into these myopic issues. And I've read a person, I hadn't read the article, but the person kind of read, I wrote an article on people in public service since the 14th Amendment who have actually been held accountable to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Now, probably need to get my hands on that. I haven't seen it, but I'm just way too busy, and I apologize. I can only consume so much, and give me academic complaints. Give me academic, you know, hey, GR, what about this academically? Because that's really where we need to be. I get pulled into so many times, you know, what do you think about what this person is saying? You know, whether it's Tucker Carlson, it doesn't matter who the person is. 9 times out of 10, they're just trying to appease the paradigm. They're just trying to play to the paradigm. If it bleeds, it leads. In other words, they know they will have you by the throat if they give you a real complaint of how people are dying because of these evil people, and that has nothing to do with the solution. They don't care about the solution. They care about the ratings. They care about, you know, the endorsements and the new contracts and how much. I mean, look at Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly is still out there. As a matter of fact, I think he pops in on the Sean Hannity show. I think I heard him once at least. And so, here's a good guy. He's a decent guy, but he only cares about his money and himself. He has never cared because I've made appeals to him, and I've actually seen how my appeals had influenced what he was saying, and I'll get back to that as soon as we come back. We'll be right back after this short promo. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me get into how I claim I influenced Bill O'Reilly during his TV show, and I know I influenced Glenn Beck. Now, as I was getting ready to write my book, this was like 2010, 2011, 2012, I was like you, average guy that, you know, was engaging with all these different conservative people and sending emails, and I was constantly emailing Bill O'Reilly regarding the Constitution, compliance of the Constitution. And I was clearly, you know, pointing out how the federal government had no constitutional authority to actually pass Obamacare, which had just passed. And I gave him, you know, the details on the Madison's veto, on the bonus bill, all sorts of things. And it got to a point that when I would give him a hard time and I would, you know, basically say these things are unconstitutional and you're presenting them as if they're legitimate, he would bring Judge Napolitano on because he'd say, hey, for those constitutionalists, I mean, they would never acknowledge. As a matter of fact, Glenn Beck never acknowledged me. But I know directly because I never had a back door to Bill O'Reilly. But there's no doubt in my mind, the way I was writing these emails and giving him all the academic facts. I mean, these weren't just, hey, you're a blowhard or, you know. And so when people send me stuff that actually provides me some detailed information with, you know, the citations and so forth, I mean, that's a pretty serious person. Especially when you're giving them source documents, not just editorials, not just arguments, you know, because I was basically saying, how can you refute this? This is what Madison said. Anyway, so he was actually under the gun, or he felt at least under the gun, that he'd bring Napolitano because he probably, there's no doubt, I was creating these things as open letters, that I was sending this out to email chains and so forth so that people would kind of see what I was just sending Bill O'Reilly to get them to harp on him too. Did the same thing with Glenn Beck. And as a matter of fact, I was hitting him on Facebook. I was sending emails to, I think it was his email address was me at Glenn Beck or the whatever. I forget. I could pull him up. But in 2016, when Trevor Lawton and I were the keynote speakers at the Constitution Association's gala dinner. His wife, Trevor Lawton's wife, was sitting right next to me. And when I got up and I talked about the importance of Madison's veto on the bonus bill in 1817, She was absolutely tickled. So when I came back, and because I talked about Republic Review, enumerated powers, that they don't have the power to just do anything they want to do, that the courts, the mystical clauses, there's just no way to actually assume these types of powers. They have to amend the Constitution. So when I came back and sat down, she just was, I mean, giddy. I mean, she goes, you know, and what, this is what she explained to me. She said that she, and I didn't know this until after I gave that presentation. She sat down, or I sat down next to her because we were done eating dinner, of course, by this time. And she was so giddy, and she explained to me that she actually worked for Glenn Beck. And that she was a researcher for Glenn Beck, and there was another person. And when Glenn Beck, apparently after I'd been prodding him and prodding him and prodding him, I basically, over the Madison, you know, I said, you need to understand Madison's veto is so critical. It destroys any argument that the federal government cannot assume any power. And, you know, and the details regarding the four mystical clauses within that. I mean, I sent him several emails and sent several messages. And you know he gets the message, or at least somebody's getting it, because you get that little dot in Messenger that says, yep, somebody saw it, they've read it. At least they've seen it. You don't know where they've read it. So I had no idea that I was landing anything, because he never responded. Never. He never addressed this topic in any of his shows. At least at that point in time, I was still watching his dumb TV show. And so, actually, I think his TV show was over, and this is when he was decimated. Or I should say, when he had to go to the blaze after Fox fired him and all that. And so she was telling me that, you know, she did all the research for him, and she says, you're absolutely right. And I gave him all of that information. Now, there's no way anybody else was telling and talking and basically trying to lay a foundation to build from regarding that particular veto. Nobody. And as a matter of fact, the fact is that because he's basically buried that information and Bill O'Reilly's buried that information, and even though these guys are popular, when I tell you that they really don't care about the truth and the facts, they don't. They don't care about the truth and the facts. Now, they try to ascend to a level of popularity to where they become greater, or in their own opinions, they become great. I mean, look at both O'Reilly and Glenn Beck felt that they were untouchable, and they were both taken down. Now, Beck was taken down just because he was just wandering so far. And you know what? He's a very good teacher, because when he did his work on a chalkboard, he's better than me in articulating, you know, a presentation like that, how he was able to sit down and do that. Bottom line is, Bill O'Reilly was taken down because of the supposedly this long-running sexual harassment. Or I should say this, it's the same thing with Bill Cosby. You know, people that try to do good and they get to a point where the people have a popularity, then boom, they get taken down. Not just a notch, they get leveled. Now, I know I'm not a perfect person. I don't even want to be at the pinnacle of anything. Now, I've told you last year that if you voted for me for the president, that, you know, cast in a write-in ballot for G.R. Mobley, then okay. But I'm not going to campaign. I'm not going to go there, because I don't care about that. I only care about getting people to become constitutional warriors, to be champions of the Constitution and bring back constitutional orthodoxy. In other words, this concept, the concept of purity in enforcing the Constitution and holding our public servants to the oath. So in the roundabout way, in concluding how important that oath of office really is, these people that want to step into what has gone from the most, the greatest government of the world to the most corrupt government of the world. Because instead of doing the people's bidding, and instead of abiding by the rule of law, people of avarice have stepped into our positions of power, into public service, to aggrandize themselves, to get rich, and to rise above the common man. And the only way they were able to do that was from the lucre of corporations and those who wanted it all, those who wanted to control it all. Now, I've mentioned this before, and I say this, and I lead to this all the time. If you read John Robison's article, or actually it's a book, of the a conspiracy to destroy the religions and governments of Europe. I believe that's what it is. It's on my website, and I believe it's on either the Constitutional Articles page or on the Red State Talk Radio podcast page. And as a matter of fact, since I'm on the Red State Talk Radio podcast page, I'm sorry, blah, blah, blah. It is on the very bottom. It's the final article on the Red State Talk Radio podcast page. If you want to read a book that talks about the conspiracy theory, this is probably the first and most original book out there, because this baby was written in 1798, talking about the Illuminati and everything else. I mean, every other book, even mine, pales in comparison. Actually, I don't even go down the path. I just basically take it from what he's done and on at a macro view of how the conspiracy has grown and grown and grown. And it could only grow in America because we're not abiding by the Constitution. We've failed to abide by that Constitution, and we've been able to basically, as new states came in, we created perverted constitutions at that. Even though we find that in some of the western states like Wyoming, we have, you know, a real strong constitutional presence, it's very hard to get these people to realize that the Wyoming state constitution is in ways an abomination under the U.S. Constitution. Any state, and many of the western states have this, any state that has a clause that subjugates that state to their child has created a perverted relationship, because that clause that says we are an inseparable member of the union basically subjugates them to the federal government, and that is unconstitutional, and it violates the essence of Article 4, Section 3 of a state coming into the union as a sovereign state and as an equal-footed member of the union, to where they are equally footed as all the sovereign states and as a parent to that federal government. So let me just get back to what I wanted to, what else I wanted to say, because I think I've ran the oath point to the end. Now, if there's more issues, if you feel like I haven't addressed everything regarding the oath and how important the oath is, and the oath of the Constitution. Now, when we talk about it, remember that if you're not telling your public servant the fact that there are two constitutions, before they step into office, they are going to be bamboozled and misled, and they are going to be used as puppets and shills. So, anyway, as I move back into this, and that's a good part of the exorcism of the politics of the day. So it really does line up, which is why I favorably chose on Feedback Friday to really highlight the oath last Friday, because it really is a part of the misinterpretation and the, I'll just say, how we've been perverted, and we have to exercise all of these perversions to get to the truth. So, again, let's move forward back into these amendments that are specific that I was talking about regarding the exorcism of politics within the United States. And I'm sure you, as well as I, thought that I had been done, because I really, at the end of either last Friday or the Friday before, I kind of thought that I kind of went through ad nauseum on the 14th Amendment. But I hadn't. I realized as I was looking at my bullet list of things I needed to cover, there were still a few things that really I need to point out. So, and the reason why I need to point these things out is because, remember, there's that article that was done by Mr. Lyons, right? L.C. Lyon, and The Day Our Country Was Stolen. And he talks in this article about the 17th Amendment and how the president at the time vetoed it, well, or refused to sign it. Show me in the Constitution where that's even the process. I believe he's basically either got his wires crossed or he is dubious in trying to convince you that the 14th Amendment was rejected by the president but still went forward, and that's not the process at all. What he's doing is he's mislabeling the Civil Rights Act of 1866. That was vetoed, and they came back and overpowered it. But as soon as they were overpowering it, they realized it was a Pyrrhus victory. In other words, they may have, you know, shot their wad and was able to overcome him, but it was still inept because an act like the Civil Rights Act has no teeth and it cannot be enforced within states. The only thing that can be are laws in pursuant to the Constitution. So they passed that act. They needed to pass an amendment to the Constitution that would give that act teeth. Now, it took them, and I covered this. I know I covered this, but there's a lot of misinformation. And so I go back to, there's nowhere in the course of history other than the 14th Amendment where we actually had public servants provide the power to the people and the supreme law to hold and nail public servants to the wall. Takes away their due process. They don't even have, you know, when you hear about an impeachment process in a state legislature, I am telling you that's an unconstitutional process when it comes to the impeachment of a governor, or when it comes to the impeachment of a legislator, the impeachment of a judge. Section 3 basically nullified the impeachments of everybody except the president and the vice president. In other words, there is to be no trial. If you violated your oath of office, then you are gone. You don't get any emoluments. You could be subject to a trial, a criminal trial. But if you have violated your oath or you have failed to support the Constitution, there is no trial. Read the pledge. The only thing that can actually save a person is the accused. So what is that process? They really didn't clarify that process, but I will tell you, the constitutional process to invoke Section 3 has to be done, not in the court, because when you walk into the court, you've now actually created a trial by a corrupt entity. Bottom line, a First Amendment petition into the representatives to call them out. And this is why if we the people can consume, digest, understand, comprehend the profound nature of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and our ability to basically nail every politician, every judge, every lawyer to the wall. Because why lawyers? Under this unconstitutional bar legal system that they created, an officer of the court is equally obligated, and under the 13th Amendment, any lawyer that is caught trying to deviate or trying to, you know, create a case that absolutely fails to support the Constitution and directly violates it, they should be removed from being an officer of that court and practicing law. Even though the 13th Amendment says that no person that is a part of the Bar Association can even be in court or even a U.S. citizen. Anyway, I'm here to tell you folks that the Lord really did have his hand in providing some very critical amendments and language in this Constitution that absolutely protects it and protects us. So as we look at this, you know, as I go down this path of the Constitution and these debates and the 14th Amendment, Just answer yourself this. Why is somebody actually taking away, because, you know, they may have been men, those who wrote and passed the 14th Amendment, those radical Republicans may have only been men, but they did what an angel would have done by actually providing that law be written and galvanized and codified within the Constitution. So, all these people who say, oh, that's a bad amendment. No. All those who redefined that amendment were the evildoers. And the people that say that that was a bad amendment have failed to do the due diligence. And you know what? I have ran into people that have actually, you know, people that are highly, you know, acclaimed as conservatives and constitutionalists. How many people in these alleged, self-proclaimed, we're the authority of the Constitution, like the John Birchers and others, how many of them have actually uttered those words that the 14th Amendment is a bad amendment because they didn't know anything, or I should say, they didn't do their due diligence in really seeking the truth regarding the 14th Amendment? Why is it that I can't be the only one. There has to be other people that are finding the truth, because I see other people actually talking. And the whole point is that the Section 3 thing, it's growing. People are really starting to digest this. But we need we the people to demand a quick and easy application, which is why when you read the pledge of how that is being defined, and when you read the debates of how that, they didn't do a good job. The states can clarify this, but we have such corrupt state legislatures at this point. You've got to start getting rid of these folks. And the only way we're going to do that is starting at the county by using First Amendment petitions and pledges. But anyway, let me get back to this other point that I was talking about regarding the 14th Amendment and Elsie Lyons or what have you, that, you know, how this is all misrepresented. Probably one of the best articles, and when I say articles, this is an academic article that was written by Kurt Lash. And Kurt Lash gets attacked all the time. Now, I have asked, and my producer has sought Kurt Lash to actually be interviewed on this show. I know he, you know, so the question is, did this guy just, I'm speaking in sentence fragments, I hate doing that, so forgive me. Did Kurt Lash do such a good job on the due diligence of the Privileges and Immunities Clause that he realized that he might be undoing the legal system and his career because he is a professor of constitutional law in Virginia, the state of Virginia? And I'm going, you know, it's almost like you went down this path and you created this, you know, this great thesis, you know, in a doctoral thesis or what have you, because that's what it seemed like that was a thesis. And it was a three-part thesis, by the way, of the Privileges and Immunities. So it's a long article. In that article, he really gives a very good detailed view of what was happening. If you really want to actually have a firsthand account of what was really happening in 1866 from a large body of men dealing directly with the struggle in liberty, you have to read the congressional debates on my website, and you'll find the congressional debates of the 14th Amendment on the Red State Talk Radio podcast page. Just look for that little subtitle, Congressional Debates of the 14th Amendment. Now, it's a long read, but if you really want to see what these men were really trying to do, there were opponents to liberty for all men. There were people that were trying to be disparaging comments and trying to oppose the 14th Amendment. Now, I don't know if it was because they were racist. I don't know if it was because, you know, they just didn't want to be held accountable and nailed to the wall, because they liked, every politician loves to be free to do his political theatrics and be able to make these long-winded rhetorical, what do they call that in the Senate, when they go on and on and on, and they basically, you know, hold the Senate at standstill. Forgive me. I know if Paul was listening to this, he'd be sending me a text right now. But you know what I'm talking about, when you're just basically grandstanding. Every politician wants to do that, filibuster. Every politician wants to filibuster a body of men to where, you know, they just go on and on and on and create such a long argument. And in a way, I feel like I filibuster because I've been going on. You know, I'm almost on my 2,000th episode. I'm over 1,500. So, or this summer I'll be hitting the 1,500 mark. So that's a lot of episodes of monologues and going and diving through these details and giving you different angles and views of the facts. I guess it's a long pause. I guess it is just a way to provide you the irrefutable evidence to help you take the same position. This is not, you know, it's not something that only I can do. This is not something that, you know, requires a copyright on being honest and truthful. Where, you know, Bill O'Reilly and all of these conservative entertainers, all of these organizations that claim to have the copyright on the Constitution or the truth, they don't. This is something that is shared, that we can all bear witness to the truth. So I didn't get into the Washington State slate and what we really wanted to do, and I'm hoping to get into that soon, where the power of getting a cadre, a team of men that is saying, we demand that we get Washington State, we demand Washington State get back into compliance of the Constitution. I'll talk more about the power of a race like that probably this Friday, especially if, and I think I'm going to get some feedback from a few people, if they want me to really dive into the names and the characters and what needs to be done and why this type of a campaign is so important. Every campaign is important. Every campaign. But this is a unique type of campaign that we're talking about. And to pull this off requires 100% buy-in from all characters involved. And so what it does is it changes the game. And as a matter of fact, they have the ability to really start making headway. But I'm just telling you that with the executives, it's one thing, you know, to just have a good governor. But it's a different thing when you actually have four champions in a state where the governor, the attorney general, the secretary of state, and the auditor or your inspector general, whatever that person is in your state, whatever you call them, when all of them are working together to demand constitutional compliance, the impact that that can make in a state. I mean, it's one thing, like I said, with the president to be able to do and execute the power that the United States president states when I go through the impact on a constitutional president, because he actually has control over his cabinets. Those are not elected bodies like the attorney general and so forth. That actually changes the game at the state level because of those unique races. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.